Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the Islamic Pulse talk show. We are talking about Lady Fatimatul Zahra alayha salam and her well-renowned Jihad al-Tab'een towards the end of her life, which resulted in Her Eminence's martyrdom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the Islamic Pulse talk show. We are talking about Lady Fatimatul Zahra alayha salam and her Jihad al-Tab'een. A Jihad al-Tab'een in the way and the path of Allah for the sake of Allah, which resulted in Her Eminence's martyrdom. In order to talk a little bit more about the subject, we decided to humbly invite Sayyid Agha Ali Reza from the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. So let's go ahead and welcome him and start our talk show. Of course, our condolences to all the believers all across the world upon the martyrdom of Her Eminence, the Lady of Light. Sayyid Agha Ali Reza, thank you so much for joining us on the talk show as we commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of Her Eminence, the Lady of Light, Lady Fatimatul Zahra alayha salam, and our condolences to you and all as well. In the previous program, we had started to talk a little bit about Jihad al-Tab'een, the system of wilaya, and of course the role that Lady Fatimatul Zahra alayha salam played in all of these. We wanted to continue the discussion, you know, towards the later part of Her Eminence's life, where really her Jihad al-Tab'een becomes very ashikar, it becomes very bold, and it can be clearly seen. We continue our story from there, handing it over to you in the name of Allah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me again. So in our previous discussion, we established the groundworks of our discourse, and we said that everything that Hazrat Zahra Salamullah alayha was doing was within this model of Jihad al-Tab'een.
Yes.
And this in itself is rooted in the Quranic basis of Tab'een, because we understand that all of the Immaculates alayhimus salam, all of the Infallibles alayhimus salam, are their basic responsibility and their basic, the philosophy of their creation and their existence and the reason why God sent them amongst humanity is in order to clarify truth from falsehood and give that guidance that can lead humanity to comprehensive and holistic success.
And this is what we had said in the previous program in the talk show, was that Tab'een, meaning this ultimate clarification between truth and falsehood.
Absolutely.
Which leads to two things, I believe you had said.
Yeah.
One is that doubt and that suspicion gets clarified and the truth is revealed.
Exactly.
And on the other hand, it also disarms the troops of falsehood.
Mm-hmm. So it completely destroys the propaganda that exists. And obviously later on, it gives the enemy two choices, and not more than two choices. The enemy can either accept the truth and come into the folds of Islam and become mu'min, which is something that is always desirable.
Of course. We
in terms of our true and essential responsibility, we are always looking to guide people towards the truth. We are never looking to kind of remove them from the scenario. So you see, force them into coming into the folds of Islam. That is something that Taghut does. The Taghut will either force you to come into their the perimeter of thought, or they will remove you from existence. So that is not something that primarily we're doing. But in exceptional cases where things have gone so bad that now there is no choice, there Allah decides and gives this jurisdiction to the mu'mineen to fight the kuffar, right? But anyway, coming back to the actual topic. So
you said that there was two. So one is that we willingly, that
the enemy willingly joins, understands
and accepts,
the truth,
understands
says, oh,
the truth.
This is very interesting.
Has a
like like the magicians in Pharaoh's court.
Right.
When they see what's going on, they say,
"This is from Allah."
This is from Allah, and we now believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and in Islam at that stage, right? But normally they take the other option.
They react in a different manner.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because when their interests are being attacked, they come back and they try to destroy the source of this Tab'een.
Mm-hmm.
And at that stage in itself, you have already won. The person doing tabheen has already won because he's disarmed the enemy of all logic. Right. The enemy must now resort to violence, needs to resort to, for example, sanctions, anything that is illogical, anything right. that is basically an act of bullying and tyranny.
Mm. Well, so, these recent riots that we saw in the Islamic Republic.
Sanctions throughout the history of the Islamic Republic. The war that was forced onto them.
8-year sacred defense.
8-year sacred defense through their proxy, which was Saddam Hussein. Mm. Then the economic war, even war against the children. Like you have children here who are in hospitals, who are in need of medicine, which is monopolized by the West. And they even stop the trade of this medicine for the Islamic Republic, which is a complete crime against humanity. Right. And then creating
this unrest and
rioting and chaos and so on and so forth. And also pressurizing allies of the Islamic Republic throughout the world in order to abandon the Islamic Republic. All of these are instances of bullying, of oppression. There's no logic behind it.
When the enemy realizes that they have lost and that they can't win.
They've lost the narrative.
And they've lost the narrative, then they resort to these things.
They must resort to these
things. It's interesting. I kind of, well, when you were talking about this and describing how the enemy, you know, really reacts in two ways. One is that they accept the truth and they wholeheartedly accept the truth. Mm. Actually, I'd like to add this. One is that they accept the truth, they realize the truth, they accept the truth, and they accept it wholeheartedly. Mm. The second, I think, is because they know that it's the truth, right? They just don't accept it. They reject it. And perhaps, even though, I don't know if we want to open this door in this chapter, but this is where the kufr comes into play.
Absolutely.
Is where the second option, they've realized it's the truth, but now they are, you know, consciously, willingly, voluntarily, they are rejecting the truth, right? But when you were talking about this, it reminded me of Amr ibn Abdawad, when he came to face Imam Ali alayhi salam in the field, and Imam Ali said that, you know, I give you the option to you know, not get into a fight and you can become Muslim. And he said, no, you know, that I'm not going to accept, because his interests were not in accepting Islam. It was interesting. He said that if I accept Islam, then the women of the Arabs and our own tribe will make fun of me. So in the same scenario, I think that these taghuti powers and these arrogant powers of the world, they don't accept the truth because they'll lose all their vested interests.
Exactly. Mm. In fact, going a step forward, once they've understood that they've lost the narrative, that they've lost all hope of trying to somehow concoct some logical framework for what they're doing, and when they are totally unmasked and the true and the falsehood is completely becomes manifest for all people to see, there they understand that this truth in itself is an existential threat.
Right.
So it needs to be removed.
Right.
So linking this back to
this is what I was going to say. Mm. Now that you know, perhaps viewers might think that, well, these two, well, you're the scholar, I'm the student, but these two have taken the track so far out. Mm. Now I want you to bring it all the way back in, right into the heart of the matter and how this applies to Lady Fatimatu Zahra alayhi
salam. So you see that Lady Fatimatu Zahra salamullah alayhi as the defender of wilaya in those days, you see that once she has provided this argument, and I'd like to say that providing this argument and saying it out for the people and explaining it to the people is not just through speeches. It's not just limited to Khutbah Fadakiyah, for example. It's the entire way that she's behaving when the wilaya of Amirul Mu'mineen is being challenged. So when she's stopping people from coming into the house, when she's standing behind the door and blocking it, and trying to stop people from getting into the house, and from behind the door, she's speaking to these people, and she's speaking with a loud voice, as it has been narrated in history, and she's talking about what her status is. She's reminding them of the fact that she's the daughter of the Holy Prophet. She even calls out to the Holy Prophet, and she rebukes the people there. She reprimands them there by saying to the Holy Prophet that, look at what these people are doing to me after you, and so on and so forth. So she's creating this, she's disarming the enemy in terms of any shade, any iota, any inkling of legitimacy that their act might have. For example, if she had not done this, history might have said that this was the system of the day, this was the government, and every government is allowed to enforce its writ upon the citizens. Why should it let a dissident create dissension within society? So if that dissident isn't listening to what the government is saying, the government will move against them. They will arrest them and put them in a prison or something of the sort, right? But that only applies to a legitimate government.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Lady Fatimatu Zahra stands behind the door and destroys the legitimacy of the people gathering outside. So at this stage, the people outside have only two ways to react. They can either say, oh yes,
Our government is illegitimate.
Yeah, what we were doing was wrong. We are sorry. We apologize.
We give the right to the rightful owner.
Which, interestingly, I should point out is that because the Ahlul Bayt are basically, they are Noor-e Wahid, they're one ray of light, right? From the Prophet himself to the last Imam. And the Prophet himself is Rahmatul Lil Alameen, his mercy to all mankind, of to all existence, right?
Yes.
Even when the Ahlul Bayt are in position where apparently they are being oppressed, they are being martyred, and they call out and they rebuke and they reprimand and reproach their enemies, even then their primary objective is guidance.
Sure.
So the hope, even a minute hope, that someone at some level, either intellectual or spiritual or emotionally, will go away, will turn back, will say, oh, he'll realize, or he or she will realize that I'm making a mistake, is always there. And that is the primary objective.
We see this in Sayyidul Shuhada Imam Hussain,
exactly,
alayhi salam, where
exactly,
throughout the day of Ashura, he is continuously trying to guide and save
even
these
people.
Even
at the time when the mal'oon, the accursed person, comes and sits upon his chest, and he's about to engage in that heinous act of beheading Imam Hussain alayhi salam, Imam Hussain reminds him about a narration from the Holy Prophet.
Allahu Akbar.
And he says that, how truthful was the Prophet? Mm. And this person, he replies, he says that, what did the Prophet say? So Imam Hussain says that the Prophet told me that a person with the face of a dog, with these
marks
like a dog, will be the person who will come and act in this manner with me, right? So here we intellectually, as academics, as students, we are faced with the question, was this just an act of desperation by mazallah, a dying man? That I can't do anything else right now, at least I can insult this guy, right? And even though, and because I am sadiq, I'm truthful, I'm not going to insult him by saying something false. I'm going to tell him this hadith. Is that what he's trying to do? Is he that he's trying to empty himself? Here is where we do qiyas-e bin-nafs. We compare these luminaries to ourselves, and mazallah, we kind of copy-paste our weaknesses to them and see them in that light, and which is completely wrong. But now if that option is wrong, the only other option that remains is this. Imam Hussain is still hopeful of guiding this person.
That maybe he'll be shocked into
be
the
shocked.
Hearing this and,
exactly.
and say, I won't kill
like
you.
Like, for example, Zubair in the Battle of Jamal.
Jamal, yes.
When Amir al-Mu'mineen reminds him that one day we were sitting next to the Prophet and you were smiling at me, and the Prophet said, do you love your cousin? Do you love Amir al-Mu'mineen? Do you love Ali alayhi salam? So Zubair says, obviously I love him, he's my cousin. And then the Prophet is silent for a while, and then he says, one day you'll be holding a sword against him. And he becomes extremely sad and disturbed, and he just walks out. When Amir al-Mu'mineen reminds him of this, even though he doesn't come over to Amir al-Mu'mineen's side, he says that I'll find a way, and I'll just run off, right?
Yeah.
So that is at least one stage of reducing the criminality of an individual, reducing the amount of punishable offense, right? This in itself is mercy.
And they're constantly guiding.
And they're constantly
guiding.
This is,
you were talking about Lady Fatimatu Zahra.
The interesting thing is that the existence of these individuals can never be separated from Jihad-e-Tabeen. It can never be separated from mercy. It can never be separated from generosity. They and all the virtues that they manifest, that they embody, are all one thing. It's not like us. It's not like Agha Ali Raza being generous at times when I am in a good mindset and being extremely ingenerous and unaccommodating at other times when I'm, for example, very tired.
Not in a good mood.
These are things that are relatable to people like us, weak people who haven't reached that pinnacle of excellence. But the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, being these immaculate models, being these infallible and perfect models, all of the virtues are one and the same at the same time. So coming back to Hazrat Zahra salamullah alayhi, when she's rebuking and reproaching these people from behind the door, when she's accepting and in a manner acknowledging the price that she has to pay for defending Amirul Mu'mineen, and when she's receiving all those wounds and allowing her body to receive these wounds as well, because in a manner, like, there's always this question, couldn't she like ask Allah for help and the angels would rain down, and like they contemplate about Karbala as well, right?
Right, yeah, sure. Right.
Why do the Ahlul Bayt allow themselves to suffer in this manner? Because that suffering itself is designed to persuade at least one individual from stop doing it, right? Now, if that does not occur, if that is not actualized, for example, the criminal approaches and you are suffering and you're still trying to guide them, and guidance does not occur, what is the other side of the coin? Itmamul Hujjah. Now, arguments have been fulfilled on the day of judgment. This criminal can say nothing in defense of him or herself, right?
Right.
So these guidance and itmam hujjah are two sides of the same coin. So Hazrat Zahra, behind the door, she's doing this, she's reaffirming, she's destroying the legitimacy of
the illegitimate
government, the tyrannical government.
And at the same time, she's reminding of the wilaya of Amirul Mu'mineen,
because
of the Messenger of Allah.
She's defending Amirul Mu'mineen. And obviously her defense, again, coming back to the roots of the foundations of our belief, this is not a defense, an emotional response, an instinct, a spousal instinct or a maternal instinct to save her children, for example, who are in the house. No, this is the response of a woman who is the model for the Ahlul Bayt themselves. This is the response of a woman who has already been told at some level or the other what will happen in the future and how she will be faced with these problems, right? So this is a woman who, at the same time of experiencing all those emotions at a depth that we cannot even imagine, at the same time is constantly strategizing in order to guide these people, save the wilaya, destroy the legitimacy of the criminals, affirm the legitimacy of the true wilaya. Everything is going on at the same time.
Right.
So maybe if you want to imagine how this works, imagine a soldier in the battlefield. When we are sitting in our own houses in luxury, we become forgetful. Some of our faculties don't work. If we are doing intellectual work, our emotions kind of are cancelled out. If we're doing something that is emotional, our intellect kind of stops playing a role. But when we are put into a situation where all our faculties need to work at the same time, because it's either fight or flight, right? Even normal people work at a level of multitasking that is maybe it's exceptional in its form, right? Now, that is just an example, because we're still talking about weak, normal people. Now, consider, just try to expand that to an infinite scale, so that maybe we can understand what's going on within the person of one of these infallibles. Emotions at a level that are they cannot be parallel. There's no parallel to them within other people, right?
Right.
At the same time, you have mercy at a level which is only comparable to the mercy of God underneath His mercy. Then you have the intellect, which is never put on the side and is always governing all these other faculties, and therefore the strategizing and the jihad al-tabin continuously, even at times when they physically have been drenched. And you have Abi Abdullah alayhi salam in Karbala with all those wounds, he's still doing jihad al-tabin, right down to the last stage. So, Hazrat Zahra, we see in that, in the scenario of the street of Bani Hashim, we see this happening. Then when they finally break down the door and they capture Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and they're taking him off, Hazrat Zahra decides to go from the street instead of going from the other door which leads directly to the mosque, because this was the only house that had a door leading directly to the mosque. She goes from the street, she is confronted by some of these criminal elements, and we read in history how she was insulted and she was attacked. But she allows this to happen because this is part of her strategy. This suffering is part of the strategy.
And, I mean, if I add, because sometimes when this kind of allows, brings in this idea of self-inflicted harm, where here, when we say allow, we're saying that she could have run away.
No, absolutely.
She could have stayed in the house. She could have went through the other door. She could have started screaming for help, right? Mm. These are all different kind of options
that she might
that
have
she
had.
Might have had, but she didn't do because it wasn't going to achieve the ultimate goal, which was there. And the ultimate goal, the only way that that was to be achieved was by her going and defending Imam Ali and telling them what they're doing is wrong and continuously defending. Now this, of course, incurred losses upon her.
Absolutely.
Which was which is where you were going to continue.
In fact, we can add a question to that question of yours. Sometimes when we are explaining the scenario in this manner, people might think that, okay, the Immaculates, they were somehow unemotional individuals.
Right, they didn't feel anything.
And they were
anything.
like robots. Mm. They didn't feel anything. They would just do what was logically according to their objectives, right? This is not true. As I said, again, we are comparing them to ourselves, right?
Right, right.
Because in our lives, normally, if the intellect is working, then the emotions aren't. If the emotion is working, then the intellect isn't. But this is a part, it is a manifestation, it is a consequence of our weakness, of our imperfection. Right. When you talk about these perfect human beings,
it's a perfect balance.
It's a perfect balance. Everything is working at the same time.
Right.
So if you're talking about the emotions, the sorrow that she's feeling for her father, the anger that she is feeling in God's path for the wilaya, the fear that she has for the life of the wali, everything is still there, and at a level that you cannot even imagine. If a drop of this was to be given to us at an emotional level, we would stop existing.
Right.
If a drop of what the Immaculates were feeling, if a small speck of that could be felt by us, we would go into non-existence. We won't just die, we would shatter.
Right.
So that is the depth that they are feeling. And at the same time, their intellect is not put into abeyance. It's still controlling, right? And the intellect, this divinely guided intellect, which is protected against error and against sin, it is at the same time looking at the final objective, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is the wilaya of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is the tawhidi system. And by looking at that objective, they are looking at the different options that are available. So in terms of normal people, there is an option of just running away. There is an option of becoming scared and sitting in a corner and just hoping that because I'm a woman, no one will like interact with me, no one will harm me. There is an option of screaming out, saying help, help. There's an option of going through the door which is inside the house directly into the mosque.
There
are these different options, right? Which option should we take? In fact, this is in itself a place where we should follow the model of the Ahlul Bayt, right? This is an algorithm in itself. In our lives, when we are faced with different options, should we do taqiyya here? Should we run away? Should we scream out? What type of tab'een should we do? Should it be logical, calm down? Should it be maybe like in protest? Should it be more emotional in nature? We always have these options, right?
Sure.
Should we become part, like right now, kind of negotiate with the enemy, become part of the status quo? We always have these options. How do you determine which option to take? As Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, in many of his discussions, he explains in the philosophy of ethics, he says the only way that you can determine what to do and what not to do is to compare the options to the objective. Because that is the only objective and only real criteria that you have. When compared to the objective, which has already been established, and for the Immaculates, obviously this it's is clear. Not, is mm. it's absolutely clear. It's we who struggle to some,
to see the objective,
to some
yeah.
see the objectives and need to go back to the source and get the help of the Immaculates and the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt in order to understand what the objectives are.
And the system of wilaya.
And the system of wilaya, right? Mm-hmm. But for the Immaculate, it's present. It's like presential knowledge. It's knowledge by presence. It's ilm-e huzuri, right?
Right.
So they know the objective. So when they compare these options to the objective, instantaneously it becomes clear which of these options needs to be taken in order to achieve that objective in a more efficient and more effective manner, given the circumstances.
Right. Right.
Because there is no option wherein I will not be harmed and at the same time the vilayat will be protected. Mm. Right? So she decides to go from the street. And when she decides to go from the street, this is a bit like it's not something that is very academic, what I'm about to say right now. But she kind of puts, she lays the foundation stones of what we do in our communities called julus, right?
Right,
right. Right from that very day, to go out
this
into
procession.
To take the protest into the streets. We could protest Ashura, for example, in our houses, like the secular environment tries to propagate. They say, do it in your homes, do it in your mosques, right? Why do you come out and bother everyone? But Bibi Fatimah Zahra is showing this. When your Ashura, when your lamentation for Imam Hussein, when your mourning for the other Imams is for wilaya, for protecting and preserving the wilaya and for propagating the wilaya, then you need to go into the people. You need to show them, you need to relate to them and narrate to them the suffering and the tragedy that happened so that some of them at least could get that guidance. So she goes into the street and every step that she's taking, every place that she's trying to hold herself back or she's trying to protect herself against these wounds that are being inflicted, each and every instance of this is in itself creating an instance of tab'een.
Sure.
Right? And for anyone seeing that, the people who were there, even though they might not have had the courage to defend her, but for them this hujjah, this proof was becoming finalized. How can someone or how can a group that is attacking and insulting the daughter of the Holy Prophet be legitimate? This question is there, right? And the interesting thing is that by one of the ways of what Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha achieved was by disarming the enemy in terms of logic, she kind of forced them to do this, right? Not forced them in the sense that she was the person who was leading them to do this, but because of that internal viciousness that they had two options. They could have reverted back to true Islam, right?
Right, right.
But because of that viciousness, it had to come out.
Right? It's interesting. There's a lot of similarities again with Sayyidul Shahada, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. You know, again, he could have very easily accepted the allegiance. He could have very easily left to Yemen.
Yes,
run he could away have to gone Yemen, to okay. Hind or something, you know. And he had all these options, but according to the objective, it did not fall, and these options did not fall in line with the objective, you know. And again, like you said, in this sense, you know, very loosely using the word forced, you know, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha, she forced these people to silence her.
Exactly.
Right? And in that situation with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we see that, you know, he left no option for the Yazidi governmental establishment except to silence him.
In fact, we could
and
like...
And because they realized that being silent was an option that was detrimental to the objective, they continued to speak.
Absolutely.
And when they continued to speak, the only way to silence them was to kill them.
Exactly. In fact, we could reframe the sentence in this manner, that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, when they confront the enemy of truth, with absolute truth, and reiterate that truth, and it just keeps on getting bombarded on them, right? They have no other choice if they want to preserve that identity of being a tyrant, right? If they want to preserve those interests, they have no other choice but to silence this voice.
Right.
And that is the kind of scenario that we are looking at. when we talk about Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra. Here, I'd like to put in a footnote here in terms of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, because the question might come in the mind of the audience that Imam Hassan alayhi salam acted in a slightly different manner. We should first go back to that idea of a hierarchy. The fact and the strategic decision of how a certain option is more efficient and effective in trying to achieve that objective, that higher objective, is determined by the wali himself. Because he has that panoramic knowledge of everything that's going on, right? So as Imam Khamenei in his book, the 250-year-old individual, he explains, the difference between Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein is a difference of tactic, not of strategy. The strategy is still the establishment of wilaya.
Right,
but given
right.
the circumstances, given the quality of the companions, given all of these parameters involved, and given the hope that we might be able to achieve the objective without bloodshed, and after being left alone by some of his companions, after he had taken the original objective of fighting, given all of these, the entire scenario, the entire topography of the landscape, the best option at that time for that singular and constant objective was to do what Imam Hassan did.
And well, here, because what I'm going to do, it might I don't know, might bother you. I apologize. It might bother the viewers too. But I will hold you to another talk show where we will, inshallah, talk about this difference between
Imam Hassan and Imam.
The tactics of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam versus while having the same strategy. So I will hold you to that.
Inshallah.
I apologize for cutting you off.
But
because also as far as time, we've also kind of, I know we've gone over 30 minutes now. But if you could kind of bring in this... this whole idea of the conclusionary statement on this Jihad al-Tab'een of Lady Fatima al-Zahra alayhi salam. And I know it's very difficult to conclude because, and I knew we could keep on opening this, but for lack of time, unfortunately, we weren't able to. But just this idea that, you know, sometimes you do have to sacrifice your life and your property and your wealth for the orders of the wali of the time. And for the system of wilaya, you know, and I'd like you to, in this conclusionary statement, bring in, you know, the imam of our time, because eventually, hopefully sooner than later, this wali of the time will return. And when he returns, it is going to take sacrifice, whether it's wealth or property or life or time or effort or, you know, it's going to take people coming out onto the streets, you know, and doing a jihad al-tab'een and clarifying matters. If you'd like to kind of jambandi and conclude on those in the name of Allah.
So within the person of Hazrat Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, we have this a pinnacle of a model of jihad al-tab'een, in which every step of the way, even the way that she is buried, which is in itself is constructed by her, it is her brainchild, so as to speak, that I need to be buried in the night, away, secretly, and nobody should know where I am buried. At every step, she is forming, it's like this mind is completely dedicated to creating proof after proof after proof after proof of the legitimacy of the wilaya and the illegitimacy of its enemies, right? So this is something that we should be aiming for. Obviously, we can never reach that stage or that that height of utter dedication, because that is something that is for the infallibles. As Amirul Mumineen alayhi salam, he talks to some of his companions and he says that you cannot be like me, but you can help me. And then he explains how they can help. So he says, "Aynuni bil wara'i wal istihad wal iffati was sudad," by piety, through piety and through hard work and through piety in terms of sexual piety and of morality in that manner, and sudad of being very things that you do should be things that are properly planned and properly executed.
Sure.
So they are perfectly done, right? So obviously we can't reach that stage, but we can still be in that path. So we should kind of start thinking in this manner. How does my existence within a community, how does me studying at university or at college or even in the Hausa, how my participation in society, how my participation within the family, how me being a husband or a wife or a son or a daughter, how can this be transformed into an instance of tab'een? How can the way I dress be transformed into an instance? Many of our teenagers, they feel this peer pressure, they want to follow the fashion of the dominant patterns in society, the mainstream right, pattern. Right. If they could understand that this in itself, because it is an expression, the true way they dress is an expression,
it is, yeah.
This in itself is jihad al-tab'een. So if they're dressing in a proper manner, then they are promoting iffat and morality within society. Mm. They're promoting this pledge of allegiance to wilaya within society. They're promoting loyalty to Allah within society. They're promoting even the political system. For example, Ayatollah Araki, he used to be in England, and his daughters used to go to school. They used to wear the chador, right? So people would call them daughters of Khomeini. Mm. And they would say, yes.
Yes, we are daughters.
We are daughters of Khomeini, and that is exactly why we're doing this. Mm. Even though, like maybe from a very narrow fiqhi perspective, someone could say, "Oh, do your hijab. No need for chadar here, right? Do your proper hijab, but don't do chadar like many of the sisters in the West, right?" But they used to do this because they saw this as a slogan of the revolution.
Right.
So, the entire parameter, the entire paradigm of our mind shifts, it changes, right?
Sure.
So taking this model from Bibi Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha and applying that to our is in itself a prerequisite to the reappearance of the Imam. Because once the reappearance occurs, then the jihad is more of it will be geared up.
It'll be right? Much more serious.
Much more serious. Mm. Providing some of the preconditions for the reappearance itself requires jihad al-tab'een.
Sure.
Right.
Sure.
So if the majority of humanity still believes in the lies of Western hegemony, still believes that America wants to provide freedom and democracy and liberty and fraternity and brotherhood to society, if they are still so oblivious to the truth, then obviously Imam will not reappear in order to force his will upon a overwhelming majority of humanity. Mm. It is our responsibility to go out into society and change this dynamic. Change this, because as we see in the dua of Imam Zaman in the last phrase, "Ardaka taw'a," okay, the earth will accept the Imam with a complete and like with open arms, right?
Yes.
The earth obviously is a metaphor for humanity, right? So humanity would have reached a stage of understanding, of getting clarity in terms of truth and falsehood, in terms of justice and oppression, that when the perfect manifestation and personification and embodiment of that justice comes in front of them, they would say, this is what we were searching for.
Let's open arms.
And let me say this as well. They'll say, this was what we were searching for because we had seen a reflection of it in the leadership that we had before. Mm. For inshallah, if may Allah hasten the reappearance of the Imam, and may Imam Khamenei transfer this flag to the Imam himself, hafazahumullah. When people will look at Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they would say, this is the perfect manifestation of something that we had seen as a preview, as a very strong preview in the person of Imam Khomeini, in the person of Imam Khamenei, right? That is the linkage that we need, inshallah, to create within society.
Jazakallah khair. Thank you so much, Sayyid Agha Ali Raza, for joining us on the talk show. Every time we get to talk, it's just more and more things begin to open up, but unfortunately, lack of time is always an adversary, for lack of a better term. Our condolences again upon the martyrdom, the truly heartbreaking martyrdom of Lady Fatima Zahra alayha salam, and her very beautiful and eloquent Jihad al-Tab'een, which has been etched in the heart of history for all of eternity. Jazakallah khair wa afiyah. And dear viewers, thank you so much for joining us on this special, where we commemorated And we remembered the mission and the martyrdom of Lady Fatima Tuz-Zahra alayha salam, her auspicious jihad al-tab'een, and what we can do in the present day in order to hasten the reappearance of the son of Lady Fatima Tuz-Zahra alayha salam, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. That's all from us from here. Fi amanillah and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Where have you?